John Scott.
The following program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the host and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Joining us now, Abigail Spanberger, Congresswoman Spanberger representing the 7th District of Virginia. That's the Central Virginia area. She's a Democrat. She's one of the ones that got elected in the Democratic wave, one of these so-called moderates that won a Trump district defeating Dave Brat there by 6,000 votes. She will be up for re-election in 2020. It'll be a hard-fought battle, no doubt. There's already one Republican running. I can't think of her name. Tina, somebody from somewhere. But Abigail likely to face off with Nick Freitas, House of Delegates member, who I'm convinced is going to run for that seat and be the nominee. But that's just my predictions, and of course my predictions are always right. Joining us now, Abigail Spanberger, Congresswoman. Great to have you with us.
Thank you so much, John. It's great to be with you.
So here you are in Congress, and you got elected on a platform to get things done. You're a former CIA. You're a mom. You're not used to sitting around and wasting time. But here we have today, coming down the pike, you have H.R. 6, an amnesty bill, which is going nowhere. McConnell's already said it's DOA in the Senate. Basically, the bill is giving amnesty to everybody. How do you stand on that, Congresswoman?
Well, so I would love to reiterate your point. I love to get things done. I have at times been frustrated by what happens in Congress and at times been very heartened by what happens in Congress. We have passed a number of really good bills, really strong bipartisan bills recently. Just the week before last, we were back in our districts last week, but before that we passed the Secure Act, which was overwhelmingly bipartisan, and it allows people to use their 529 savings, for example, on apprenticeship tools and equipment, so really expanding access to the sorts of programs that will allow people to have economic opportunity across what their chosen job choices might be. But to address the bill that you're bringing up, I think it's incredibly important that we have individuals who are in this country through no fault of their own, who came to this country when they were children, who are in our schools, who are working in our hospitals, working in our schools, working as police officers in our military. And it was under executive order under the last administration that they were given certainty and the ability to stay here. And I think that it's Congress's responsibility to actually legislate these things. I don't think it's appropriate for everything to be done by executive order. And so I am pleased that we as a Congress are going to be giving certainty to these individuals so that, you know, they can do things like buy houses and they can know that they're going to be able to stay here and they've lived their whole lives as Americans effectively and that they actually get to start on the path towards doing that.
All right, so it sounds like you're going to vote in favor of H.R. 6.
As it stands now, yes.
Okay, thank you. Do you think there's a crisis at the border, Congresswoman?
I would say that there is a tremendous challenge. Some might call it a crisis, and so I'll call it that. We have people who are fleeing violence in their home countries, and we do not have the ability to process everyone who is arriving here filing for asylum. What I think is the real problem is that we're actually not really being honest about how we address it. And I think that that's a problem on both sides of the aisle. I think that always putting together immigration and border security is troublesome. If we're looking at immigration and the causes of immigration, and there are so many different buckets, there's agricultural workers, there's high-skill workers, of course, there's those who come here fleeing violence and looking for asylum. But we need to look at the infrastructure that exists. And so, you know, we don't have enough immigration judges to process individuals. We also have pulled back significantly, and this year's budget from the White House cuts non-defense national security spending by about 24%. And so, you know, part of the challenge here is what changes have we been making in recent years, and what could we be doing to ensure that people don't want to come here? You know,
so here's,
I've heard colleagues, talk about our counterterrorism fights is, you know, we fight on other people's soil, so the fight doesn't come here. When I think when we're looking at the challenges of humanitarian issues, I mean, people don't want to flee their countries.
These people in the southern hemisphere has been taking our money. You have no idea where that money goes. No one knows where it goes, and it goes to the elites down there. And to think that we could just, you know, if taxpayers in the U.S. just fork more money over and give it to elites in Guatemala, somehow it's going to solve the problem. I mean, nobody believes that.
John, let me be very clear. I don't think we should just be forking over more money. I don't think we should ever be spending any money without a real significant strategy. And that's really, as somebody who I count myself as very fiscally responsible, we have to be looking at the places where we're actually making investments. And instead, we are always, as a country, particularly in recent years, been reactive. We're reactive in the way we spend our money. And when you're reactive, you end up spending a lot more money. If you've got a plumbing problem in your house and you don't address it, and all of a sudden all of your pipes explode, that is so much more expensive than if you had gone out and taken the time, made a plan, gotten your pipes fixed early. And I think that's maybe a ridiculous analogy, but I think the point is well made that we need to be looking at things preventatively. We need to be creating strategies, and not one-year strategies, appropriations bill to appropriations bill, but truly long, concerted efforts to show and demonstrate leadership in a way that impacts our national security positively leadership, and our role in the world.
Leadership and long-term thinking, I think you're in the wrong body for that, because I haven't really seen any of it on either side of the aisle. I mean, that has got to be the oxymoron.
Wouldn't it be great if we had a Congress
Get elected to Congress and I'm looking for long-term thinking and leadership. You're in the wrong place at the wrong time. But I appreciate the attitude. But here's the disconnect. So we have the month of May or something like that. We've apprehended 100,000 people. I mean, that's mm-hmm. and they're saying they're only getting one out of three, right? That means 300,000 people have tried to come over the border. I mean, you times that by 12 months, it's an entire city. I mean, you can't sustain this. And so then when I look at HR 6, and it's another amnesty bill. You can couch it and call it what you want. It's amnesty. And so it's basically, okay, we're getting 300,000 a month coming up from wherever to get in the United States, and now we want to give an amnesty bill, which is the further incentive to come and to come in the United States illegally. I mean, make that logic work for me.
And I understand your frustration, but I think that the challenge here is looking at the population that is the Dreamers and the DACA recipients. So these are people who came to this country as kids. And I recognize that part of your argument is that people who are coming over the border now may or may not have children with them. So are we going to be having the same conversation in 25 years?
Right.
And I would argue that that's why we need comprehensive immigration reform, because we need to get this figured out now so that we're not being reactive in 20, 25 years. But the DACA recipients that we are talking about are people who came to this country as children. There are strict parameters on this. This bill has strict parameters related to criminal offenses and criminal history to ensure that it's individuals who came to this country as children under very strict guidelines. This is the country they know is their home. They've gone through American schools. They're in college. They've joined the military. They work in law enforcement. They work in hospitals as nurses and doctors and within our community. They're adding to our community because they are a part of our community. And so I think that it's important to say, like, these are individuals who are working and living as Americans already here in this country. They're adding to our economy. They are part of our communities. And so I do think that it's incredibly important that we give them certainty, that we give them the ability to do further things that one can do when they know that they may not have to leave and be deported to a country they've never, ever known, such as buy a house, invest in property, you know, make longer-term professional goals. And I do think it's important. Now, that doesn't negate the fact, going back to your point, that we need to be discussing, well, what is our longer-term plan? We do have thousands upon thousands of people who are coming to this country and fleeing Central American violence and instability. So what do we do there? But that it is a very different group of people, a very different bucket of needs and concerns when we're talking about the DACA recipients. And I recognize that you're talking about sort of the precedents that we set. But we have long set a precedent of welcoming people in this country who live here, who, you know, give back to the economy, who are parts of our community. And that's exactly what this bill seeks to do. And that's why I support it. But it's not to the exclusion of talking about other challenges that we see related to immigration.
In a reasonable situation, that's a reasonable position. But when you've got 300,000 people trying to cross the border illegally that we know of, in a month, I think you have to take this a lot more seriously, because you're really right now looking at an open borders situation. And so the president says, look, Mexico is not cooperating with us, so I'm going to put these tariffs, 5%, 10%, 15%, 20%, 25%. I'm going to bring them to the table. I'm in favor of that. What about you?
So I'm not in favor of putting taxes on American consumers, which is exactly what tariffs are. And I'll raise this question.
Well, illegal immigration is costing us $1 billion a week. I mean, there's the tax right there. It's $1 billion a week. So now you're afraid of paying another 5 cents for a six pack of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, and we're paying $1 billion a week and taxpayer funded to support the illegal. So I think that's a strong
argument.
But then
it goes back to the question of being reactionary versus proactive. And my question, to which I would pose to the president, is what does he want Mexico to do? Because, again, here we need to have a set strategy. Mexico is challenged by some of the similar challenges that we have. They have individuals who are arriving at their border, passing through Mexico in groups of people seeking to arrive at the United States. And so, in fact, Mexico should be one of our strongest partners in addressing this issue, because they are also impacted by it. It is impacting them in a similar, but not the same way as it's impacting us. But rather than making Mexico our maybe strongest partner in saying, how do we address this issue? How do we help in the region? How do we stabilize things? How do we work in favor of our own security so that we do not have thousands of people crossing through Mexico with the goal of entering the United States? And instead, we are creating an adversarial relationship with the country that should, in fact,
well,
be
not cooperating.
Our closest partner in this.
And that's the people who pay for it. That's the same argument.
When we go to the store and when we go to the shops, we're going to see that increase. And it's a tax on everyday Americans, but it isn't to benefit anything, because there isn't a plan and there isn't a strategy and there isn't a stated goal.
Congresswoman Spamberger, the strategy is to get the Mexican government to the table. And as soon as the president imposed these tariffs, and by the way, we have a $350 billion trade deficit with them going their way. So they're looking at this and saying, oh, my God, if this thing ever got to 25%, we're going to lose $90 billion. All of a sudden, they fly a contingent to Washington to try to negotiate with the Trump administration in order to get action at the border. So they're just not opening up this tubular pathway and letting people come in. And so this argument about we're upsetting our ally, I heard that same argument when President Trump was trying to renegotiate NAFTA, and, oh, my God, we're upsetting Canada. And he got it done, and now we have a bit better deal with USMCA. So I've already heard that argument.
We don't have it yet, John, but I see your point.
Well, you have to pass it.
My question is, my background is national security. My background is in diplomacy, and, you know, certainly I believe fully that we are, we have a position unlike any other country in terms of negotiations. And I don't see it, and I wasn't privy to all the conversations, but at what point did Mexico say, we don't want to discuss this issue? At what point did Mexico say, you know, we're absolutely fine with people walking through our country desperate and, you know, fleeing on their way to the United States? That has never
been
a
action.
Mexico has not
talk
been interested in this. And I'm not
by their
Mexico,
actions.
But I don't think we needed to levy tariffs and make, you know, put prices and the increases.
Well, I tell you what, he did
the cost of
he did the same
on
thing.
Americans to get them to come to the table.
He did the same thing with the Chinese, and he got them to the table. I mean, he did the same thing. He called Xi's bluff, and he put the tariffs on China, who have been ripping us off for five decades, and he got them to the table, and he's going to get Mexico to the table. They have to do something. They're doing nothing.
John,
it's all talk.
I mean, we've got soybean farmers across Virginia and the rest of the country that are impacted. They're losing
market. Do you have a better plan?
And now the U.S. government is giving them bailouts, which I think are wholly appropriate, but they're not they cost
because
a lot
if you,
of money.
Because if you don't
but
have
at,
a border.
At the same time, we have soybean farmers who are literally losing their market share because when you haven't sold your crop in a year, the Chinese are going to go elsewhere. And, I mean, this is a concern that came up at one of my town halls in Amelia County. I had a farmer stand up and say, I don't want taxpayer welfare. I want to not lose the markets that I've worked for decades to build. And that's what's happening to me.
Well, you know what? They've been ripping us off for 50 years. They've driven down labor. They dump goods in the United States.
And John, I just introduced a bill focused on 5G network and basically working to protect our own intellectual property, trying to ensure that U.S. consumers are protected from potential Chinese hacking, protected from spear phishing efforts. And it was a bipartisan bill. I found two Democrats to join with me and three Republicans to join with us. And that bill's making progress because we recognize, and I serve on the Foreign Affairs Committee, I serve on the Agriculture Committee, so the confluence of sort of where China exists as a threat is something that's ever present to me in the committees where I serve. And so I 100% think that China is a threat. And part of the reason they're a threat is they have a long-term strategy, and they're willing to be patient, and they're willing to invest, and they're willing to challenge us not just this year, but 5, 10, 25 years from now, which brings me back to the point we discussed earlier, which is we as a country need to start being more proactive, pursuing longer term strategies and being less reactive. And going back to the soybean tariffs, China continues to be the largest foreign holder of U.S. debt. And so we've started a trade war. We've impacted some of our farmers. We have given bailout dollars, which I think we've done rightly so. But in the end of the day, we're continuing to be indebted to the country that we have started said trade war with.
Well, that's because we have transit.
There's a lot of things the government does that doesn't make sense, and that is certainly chief among them, in my opinion.
You're on the John Fredericks Radio Network. We're with Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, Democrat, former CIA. She represents the 7th District of Virginia. That is the middle of Virginia. She defeated a Republican incumbent, Dave Pratt, in 2018 as part of the reason that the Democrats are in the majority. She'll be up for re-election 2020. Congresswoman Spanberger, let's get to AUMF, authorization for military force. Let's see. I've been in here 9 years, okay? I've been asking for a new AUMF for 9 years. All I get from people is lip service. Everybody's on my show, Republican, Democrat. Oh, yeah, they're going to do it. Barbara Lee comes on my show, puts it in appropriations. 9 years later, it's never been in the well one time. When are we going to get a debate on a new AUMF?
I mean, the answer is I don't know. I will say thank you for all of your advocacy, and I'll say it's going to take political courage. One of the things that I have learned since I've been here is part of the reason, I'm sure your listeners, having spent time listening to you, are aware of the AUMF, but the AUMF was put in place right after September 11th. Mm-hmm. It allowed us to take military action against the perpetrators of 9/11 and those who gave them safe harbor. It was very, very specific over the years. It has been expanded in its interpretation, and the presidents, and we're talking George W. Bush and then President Obama and now President Trump, have been very comfortable using the AUMF as a reason to take military action in circumstances that I would argue, and I think most people would agree, are not wholly related to the actual incident of 9/11. But the challenge here is there are not necessarily enough lawmakers who want to be taking votes on whether or not we send people to Yemen or whether or not we send people to Somalia or whether or not we engage militarily here or there. And so this AUMF it becomes very, very convenient if you have a Congress that doesn't want to take votes on things that are difficult.
Exactly.
And I believe that's the point that Barbara Lee has made at various different points. I do think
exactly.
that we have a critical mass of people who are finding this as a common discussion. And I have talked on the floor with folks who we have nothing in common in terms of our ideology or the things that are important or the things that we prioritize. But when it comes to discussing Article 1 of the Constitution, the constitutional powers given to Congress, that's where we find agreement. So I actually think that there is a bit of a movement afoot. I am a bit of an optimist, so I think it might be more powerful. We'll see in the coming weeks to actually address this issue, because the bottom line is we have individuals who are entering the military now who were born after that AUMF was put in place. We have a generation of people who don't know anything other than war. we aren't having a public debate about it. The American people aren't engaged in that conversation, because when Congress makes a decision to send service members off to war or into harm's way, it isn't just about Congress taking that responsibility. It's about that being debated in the public sphere. It's about the American people being aware of what's happening. And for so many years, those who are not serving the military and do not have friends or family serving the military have been able to go about their daily lives and relatively unaware, relatively disconnected from the fact that we continue to have service members dying overseas under a very, very old and outdated authorized use of military force. And I think that that is wrong, and I think you and I agree on this. And I will say there was a movement afoot by, if you're familiar with the group Concerned Veterans for America, which is typically a very Republican voting organization, and Vote Vets, which is typically a very Democratic voting organization. Those two entities have joined together. They don't agree on much, which they, you know, very openly acknowledge, but they agree on the fact that we cannot have these endless wars. We cannot continue to work under this authorized use of military force from September, you know, from this right after September 11th. And they were on Capitol Hill 2 weeks ago, really actively engaging with people across the political spectrum, Democrats and Republicans, kind of from end to end, to talk about this issue. So I do think it's becoming ever present. I do think that it is something that people are pushing. And we have more veterans now in Congress than we have in recent past. And so with a lot of the new members who have experienced war, who have spent time in Iraq and Afghanistan, they're very attuned to this. And so I hope that they will continue to be a strong voice for this. And certainly given my background on counterterrorism, you know, I feel that I have a strong voice in recognizing what we need to continue to fight terrorism, but where we should also expect and require that members of Congress do their job and uphold the Constitution and ensure that they're the ones responsible for, you know, those powers that fall very squarely in Article 1 of the Constitution.
Well, the coalition that you just mentioned is unique because, look, it proves that you don't have to agree on everything to agree on one big thing. That's number one.
That's
the
right.
Second thing is, Abigail, I just want a debate, and what the leadership on both sides of the aisle are petrified of because of the money that flows in from the military-industrial complex is having a debate in the well on these wars that we're in because they can't win any of them. I mean, you look at the fact that we're still supplying the Saudis and the UAE in this war in Yemen. It is horrific. If that ever came to the floor, it would get beat by 75%, yet the money keeps flowing in, the arms keep going, the bombs keep going.
Remember, we had a vote, it seems like forever ago, I think it was about a month and a half ago. We passed, you know, we had a vote.
Yeah, but it was a procedural vote.
Yeah.
If you had a new AUMF, that wouldn't have been a procedural vote. That would have meant something because they would have pulled the funding for it, especially for you. Look, just the other day, on one of the biggest backers, the lobbyist of the UAE that was also a Trump supporter, I can't remember the guy's name. He was a fundraiser. You know, now we find pornographic stuff in his email. I mean, all this stuff, you know, it would all stop if we just had a debate on these wars. Okay, I'm almost out of time. I know you've got an initiative on prescription drugs. What is it?
Yes. So my focus on prescription drugs is greater transparency and greater competition. So we actually 2 weeks ago voted on a couple bills that would add on the competition side. The bill that I introduced is a transparency bill. So many people assess that one of the contributing factors to the rising cost of prescription drugs is the fact that there are pharmacy benefit managers. So the in-between the pharmaceutical companies and the patients and the prescribers. And there are vouchers and rebates and kind of essentially kickback style funding, but there is no clarity, no transparency in where this all occurs. And so my bill is a pretty simple one, pretty straightforward one, and it would require that those rebates and those incentives be made public. It's already information that's being provided to the government, so it's, you know, it's not creating any undue burden on these companies, which I state for the record, not because I necessarily have an opinion on that, but it is about making this information public so that individuals and researchers and patients and those on prescription drugs can have the ability to understand what are the pricing games that basically go into the final cost of their drugs. And the bill passed unanimously out of the Ways and Means Committee about 2 weeks ago, with bipartisan support, unanimous out of committee, so I'm really excited and very proud of that. And we're hoping to get a full floor vote on this bill pretty soon.
Hopefully you can get bipartisan backing on it. I appreciate your doing that. Unfortunately, what a time for this segment. Congressman Abigail Spanberger, Democrat, 7th District of Virginia. That's the Central Virginia area. Abigail, thanks for being with us. I really appreciate the time and your candor.
AM 600, 101.1 FM, WBOB.
With SRN News, I'm John Scott. A Dallas fire rescue official says one person has been killed, at least six injured, when a construction crane fell on an apartment building during a storm today with high winds. Norwegian Cruise Line says a passenger went overboard during a voyage in the Mediterranean Sea, and a search for the missing Korean woman has been called off without her being found. She went overboard on the Norwegian Epic. California will become the first state in the country to pay for some adults living in the country illegally to have full health benefits. The agreement means low-income adults between the ages of 19 and 25 living in California illegally would be eligible for California's Medicaid program. A Southern California amusement and water park has closed early after a brush fire broke out nearby and sent hundreds of visitors fleeing from heavy smoke. Six Flags Magic Mountain and Hurricane Harbor will reopen the usual time Monday. This is SRN News.
Maybe you'd like to know what exactly Relief Factor is. It was created by doctors. It's a 100% drug-free supplement with four key ingredients that simply help your own body deal with the natural inflammatory response that it has. It's easy to swallow, four little capsules in each packet, like the packet that I carry with me at all times. Three packets a day for a week, then two packets a day for 2 weeks, and I have just described the three-week quick start. And you will know in 3 weeks, that's the beauty of it, whether it works. They don't drag you on. That costs just $19.95. There's a very good chance that a very serious percentage of my listeners suffer from some sort of muscular or joint pain. You should try this for $19.95. That's all you can lose. If it works, they will send it to you automatically. If it doesn't work, tell them not to send any shipments. And it's as simple as that. It is all at ReliefFactor.com. I've been using it for years now. Relief Factor.
Hi, this is Ed Dean. Along with Roger Henderson, our dear friend Teresa Ross is leading a group of friends from the radio station on a tour of the Holy Land this fall. And you are invited to join her on this trip of a lifetime.
Imagine seeing the places we read about in the Bible, visiting the Garden of Gethsemane, getting baptized in the Jordan River, the same river where Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist, and visiting the city of Jerusalem.
Thanks, guys. I'd love for you to come with me to the Holy Land in late October. Our tour will be professionally guided by Christian Expedition. It goes from October 28th through November 6th, a 10-day trip there in Israel. And they're going to show us all the important sites, explain their significance, answer our questions as we experience the land of the Bible. If you want to find out more about that, all you have to do is call this number right now, 904-831-TRIP, 904-831-TRIP. I really hope you can go.
You're busy, so let Z-Best Original Tunas Restaurant at 7400 103rd Street help out. Z-Best Tunas Restaurant just west of I-295 offers dine-in or takeout. The original Kronos Euros, oysters, shrimp, fish, wings, and more. It's all at Z-Best Original Tunas Restaurant. A pound of gizzards or livers is just $4.99. 30 jumbo shrimp for only $9.99. Check out the new Sidewinder fries. Special discounts for military, first responders, and school employees. Z-Best Original Tunas Restaurant, 7400 103rd Street, open 7 days a week. See us on Facebook at Z-Best The Original.
Will President Trump be able to stop Robert Mueller from testifying? Did Bill Barr really lie to Congress? And who really started Russiagate? Andy McCarthy will join me in studio to give you all of those answers on the next America First with me, Dr. G. We'll also speak to Boris Epstein about the clown car of 2020 Democrat candidates and also my Salem Radio colleague, Eric Metaxas, about his new national TV show.
America First with Sebastian Gorka, Saturday nights, 6 till 9 p.m. on WBOB.
They don't call him the commander of common sense for nothing.
Guess who got out of the wrong side of the bed this morning?
Make sure to get your big boy pants on. No crybaby diapers.
There's no crying in baseball!
Here on the John Frederick Show.
You, my friends, are on the John Fredericks Radio Network. It's good to have you with us, Trucking the Truth Across America. Joining us now for an update on Venezuela live from London is Vanessa Neumann. And Vanessa is the special representative of the Juan Guaido government in Venezuela, representing his government in London. When he does take power, then Vanessa Neumann will be the ambassador to the UK from Venezuela, and she's joining us now. Some things are looking good and some aren't for the Guaido government. Vanessa, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on. Always a pleasure. I feel like we've traveled the long road together, you and I, on the Venezuela issue, and I thank you for that. So to the point, to your point, actually an interview with me was published in today's edition of the Financial Times, which, you know, is a London-based newspaper, but it's probably the most influential financial newspaper in the world, in terms that it's, you know, read by policymakers and financial markets everywhere. So the interview with me was very good, and I talked specifically about the challenges of running my diplomatic mission in the UK when we still have the usurping drug cartel occupying the building. They won't leave, despite the fact that I am recognized by the UK government. My government is Juan Guaido is recognized as a legitimate interim president by the UK, the US, and 50 other countries, 52 other countries, actually. And yet, they won't remove their diplomats, and they won't give us our buildings. So I have to. This is an effort to try and save the country in a very uneven battle. But it's a battle we're going to fight, and it's a battle we're going to win, because it's a battle that's on the right side of history, and it's in defense of my country. There is no option but to fight for my people.
Vanessa Neumann, in what should be a blow to the Maduro regime, Russia, we talked about this earlier, very early today, Russia withdraws a key defensive port to Venezuela. They've withdrawn some of their advisors in the last week. This is an embarrassment to Nicolas Maduro, no doubt, and his regime. For instance, Russian state defense contractor Rostec, which has trained Maduro Venezuela troops and their officers and advised them on securing arms contracts throughout the globe, they've cut its staff in Caracas to just 25 people. A few months ago, they had 1,000. That was at the height of their cooperation. So, knowing the Russian government and kind of following what they do, they don't want to be embarrassed. So is that not a sign that the Russian government is looking at this? And even though, you know, they made the phone call to encourage him to stay a couple weeks ago and not go to Havana, he was getting on a plane. Is this not a sign that the Russian support for Maduro is starting to waver?
And frankly, it should start to waver. It should start to waver for a number of reasons. It should start to waver partly because, you know, the international community, and that's partly my role and that of my other 25 ambassadors or, diplomatic representatives appointed by Guaido, is to build the international support network. The Russian trolls have come out against us. They're waging an online information warfare the same way they have done in the U.S. and the European elections and other places as well. Because there is no rule of law in Venezuela. So they understand that our role is important. And because we are turning the opinion of the international community against those who support Maduro, because this is a massive humanitarian crisis. This is a huge exodus that's, bigger than Syria. So they're going to lose a lot, and there'll be more sanctions against Russia for their support of Maduro. And not only that, Maduro just cannot pay them back. So what is the point of trying to prop up a drug cartel dictatorship if they basically can't pay you? They can't protect your interests. The Russians are just not going to be able to get, in the long run, what they want. And they're going to pay a high price for sticking a finger in the eye of the U.S., and oppressing 30 million of my people.
I mean, so now...
They would be wise to negotiate. They would be wise to flip sides, to negotiate, to come in line with the Constitution, to, with our Constitution, to come in line with the right side of history, And then maybe, just maybe, they can salvage some of their assets and get back some of the loans that they want to have paid back. But continuing as they are, there is no path to them getting paid. And there is no path to them really exerting control. It's only chaos.
You're on the John Fredericks Radio Network. We're with Vanessa Neumann, Special Representative of the Juan Guaido Interim Government of Venezuela. And she is the Special Representative of their government to the United Kingdom, which essentially is like their ambassador to the UK. And she's live with us in London. Vanessa, let me be straight up and ask you this. There's a movement among the American left now that is in favor of supporting Maduro, and they're calling on the U.S. to drop its sanctions, economic sanctions against Venezuela, saying that all it's doing is hurting the Venezuelan people and starving them, and it's inhumane, and the U.S. should not be involved in any of these sanctions and let the Venezuelan people figure it out. Because what they're saying is it's not hurting Maduro. The sanctions are just hurting Venezuelan people. And they can't get food. They can't get medicine. And they can't get basic necessities. Gas is, you know, $15 a gallon or something. They can't get anything. And they're blaming Trump's economic sanctions and saying he should just get out of there and stop messing with it, that whatever he's done has not been effective. How do you respond to that?
Frankly, it's a load of nonsense. Because, first of all, up until the oil sanctions, or the only sanctions that were affecting people, that were affecting the Venezuelan, the Maduro regime, were targeted sanctions against the individuals. These are punishments for massive torture, for drug trafficking, for terrorist financing, and for human rights abuses. Like, we have, over 900 political prisoners. We have over 10,000 extrajudicial killings. And it is for that, and the biggest drug cartel on the planet. It is for that sort of behavior that not only the Trump administration, but also Canada and Europe have imposed sanctions on those individuals. And we know, because they've already dropped sanctions against people who have switched sides. If you come to the right side and you support our constitution and our constitutional president, which is Juan Guaido, instead of the drug cartel of Maduro, if you come to the right side, sanctions will be dropped. So there's a very simple solution, and we know it's hurting them. We know it's effective because the first thing they say at any opportunity is drop the sanctions. So we know that. In terms of the humanitarian crisis, here's another evidence that that's a load of nonsense. The humanitarian crisis started back in 2013. We already had the indices of growing hunger, of growing inflation, of an exodus. So this started well before the U.S. even imposed any serious sanctions, which started in 2017. Obama had imposed one set of sanctions, but they were quite mild compared to what has come in since 2017 that were targeted. So there's one person to blame for the humanitarian crisis and the mass starvation of two-thirds of the Venezuelan people, and that is Nicolas Maduro and anybody who finances and supports him. And that's it. So pinning this on Trump or Canada or Europe is nonsense.
Where do you go from here? Because the Trump administration now is also getting criticism from the EU and others that, you know, maybe they played their hand too quickly here. It's turned into some kind of a mini embarrassment because, look, all the involvement they've done and Maduro is still there. I mean, it looked like his government was faltering. He's managed to maintain power. Guaido called for the demonstrations. They happen. No change. So it's gone from, okay, this is an imminent change of power to, well, maybe this guy's going to hang on.
Well, I'm going to beg to differ to that. There's a different way of looking at this. Let's look at what has happened and what has been accomplished since January. Basically, on January 5th, the National Assembly elects of Juan Guaido as its head of the National Assembly. On the 10th, the presidency becomes vacant because Maduro did not win the previous elections that were condemned basically globally, except by one Spanish politician who we now know was being paid by the drug cartel. I mean, so if we look from that starting point up until now, you see that we now have, you know, representatives around the world. We have more actions. We have growing awareness And we now have, you know, an alternate, a plan, a governance group and plan that can take over. And in terms of, let me point to a few facts. I mean, we have, a deeper, more granular understanding of the realities in Caracas. But what I can say, for instance, on the radio is look at the facts. Look at the facts. You can see, these guys were negotiating behind Maduro's back. And they were, his minister of defense, the people closest to him. And you know what? Maduro doesn't have the power to let them go. They're still there. He hasn't fired them. So the question is, who really has the power? And now he's sort of, gone to talks in Norway. My concern is that negotiations in Norway and other things, if the regime is fractured and everybody's negotiating for themselves and their own interests, who's going to really speak for the regime? How do you know that you're dealing with a credible interlocutor? So we are signs of weakness. And unfortunately, these transitions after 20 years of dictatorship, take time. They take time, and that's why we need a stronger hand from the international community and not just the U.S. You need to support the U.S.
We're with Vanessa Neumann, special representative for the Juan Guaido interim government in Venezuela, which is special representative to the U.K., which is like the ambassador, but you can't move into the ambassador's residence because the Maduro people are holding that up. They won't let her in, so the whole thing's a big mess, and it's kind of the same thing in the U.S. and other of the ambassador's residences. But let me just ask you something that you just pointed out, Vanessa Neumann. You said that there's ministers in the Maduro government right now who have negotiated him out behind his back. And obviously, if he's still in power, they're the first people you're going to fire because they're cutting you out and going their own way, and they're undermining whatever government you've still got. And you said, why aren't they fired? Who has the power? Well, let me ask you that question back. You asked it to me. I don't have the answer. Why aren't they fired then?
Well, I mean, to me, it points to, it points to a weakness. It means that he cannot let them go, that he cannot fire them. I mean, can you imagine if somebody, tried to betray Trump that way, for instance? What if, his cabinet ministers were negotiating with foreign powers to, to get him out on a plane or something? They'd be gone. They'd be gone because, Trump rules with, he rules with strength. So it's just an absolutely unprecedented situation where basically he has to tolerate even their betrayal and probably their ongoing betrayal. Because I can tell you from experience and having worked security issues and having run, my own business, somebody who betrays you once is going to betray you again. So to me, it points to the fact that this is a coalition that is, still sort of barely clinging together in order to sort of stay in power. But he does not have the absolute authoritarian power that he would like he has.
So if the U.S. shows no signs of easing or lifting any of the economic sanctions, right? So the last time we talked, it seemed imminent that there was going to be regime change, and it looked like Maduro and Guaido were in negotiation for something, like to put him somewhere and take his family and his key people. What has happened to those negotiations? It's my final question.
What are the negotiations to?
Whatever it became of them, like 2 weeks ago, it was leaked to the media that Juan Guaido was actually in direct negotiation with Maduro, and in his abdicating power, whatever you want to call it, his removal from power, where he would go, what assets he would be able to keep, his family, his close advisors. 2 weeks ago, we were told that they were in negotiation for that. So everything looked imminent. That was a couple of weeks ago that we heard nothing. Are those negotiations still going on now?
Well, so that's one of the ironies of what is happening now with the Venezuela situation. The international community criticized us for years that the opposition was fractured, that we couldn't coalesce behind one leader. Now, as of January 10th, we coalesced under Juan Guaido, and again, even more firmly coalesced under Juan Guaido under January 23rd. Now the international community is, they have fractured. You have all these conversations and all these negotiations all over the place. Lima Group, Norway, et cetera, which is going to, unfortunately, you know, complicate matters and probably give more air, more oxygen to the Maduro dictatorship. However, let me tell you where we are firm on. We are absolutely firm that President Guaido's three-step plan, which is end the usurpation, which means Maduro and his head cronies have to get out. Then we have a transitional government. The terms for that are negotiable. Who's in the government, who's not, who's in the cabinet, etc. And then free and fair elections. So this is heading to free and fair elections. That is ultimately our goal. So you need to be aware that what we are trying to do is to eventually get back to democracy with free and fair elections. And we are firm that we will not shift, that Maduro cannot run for the presidency, that he cannot be a candidate because he's been facing a case for crimes against humanity in The Hague. You can't be a brutal, torturing, drug-running capo and then, you know, and think you're going to, that you're going to abide by democratic standards. So where we stand with that is we are in negotiations because it is now, it has always been, to bring Venezuela back to democracy through as peaceful a transition as we can possibly get. That is what our people deserve. So we are negotiating and we'll see. Maduro still thinks that he can run. Maduro still thinks that he should be able to keep the presidency and that he can rig elections and that, you know, he doesn't want to have presidential elections. What he wants to do is to have fake rigged elections to completely annihilate the National Assembly, which is the only internationally recognized body of democracy. Mm-hmm. He wants to destroy the last vestige of human dignity and freedom in Venezuela. And that's the only kind of election he's willing to anticipate. So our negotiation, we continue to negotiate for our country back to democracy, and we hope that he accepts those terms, because otherwise we will never give up this fight.
Well, Vanessa Neumann, you're certainly resolved, as is Juan Guaido and many of your other supporters there, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week so we can keep getting these updates, and we're waiting for you to be named the ambassador of the Venezuelan government to UK
too.
So I can come out there to the resident, to the ambassador's complex and interview you live in London. So I'm looking forward to that. Vanessa, thank
that
you for
be
being
great.
With us. Vanessa Neumann, special representative to the United Kingdom of the Juan Guaido Venezuelan interim government. Vanessa, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, John.
Let's go to the phone lines, 888-480-JOHN, 888-480-5646. Let's get to Rich in Virginia Beach. You're on the line, Rich.
Hey, John, first of all, congratulations on being number 89 there.
Yay. Thank you. I'm excited about it to make the Heavy 100. Hey, the Heavy 100 is there's of all the radio stations in the country, of which there's thousands of radio stations and thousands of talk show hosts, I made the Heavy 100, so I'm really excited about that. And I'm even more excited that I'm not like 100. I'm like 89. So that beats being 101, right? It's all good.
I'm sick and tired of these Republican rhinos that don't have a spine, and never Trumpers. Number one, it was a Republican that signaled to Northam to about this gun bill. Why don't they leave us alone here in Virginia Beach? We're grieving. These people that do these mass murders, they're cowards. They go into gun-free zones. 90% of these murders happen in gun-free zones. If they'd have been allowed to have guns up there, I believe he never would have done it. You got a couple of buildings right across the street there that are full of cops with guns. It never happened there. It doesn't happen in the sheriff's department over there where they got guns. It doesn't happen in the prison where they have guns. It doesn't happen in the courthouse where they have guns. It doesn't happen in the other police station right next door where there's guns. It happens in the gun-free zones. The answer is not less guns. The answer is more guns. Or how about this? He had gotten in a fight with somebody. He'd been reprimanded, and you're not allowed to fire somebody so easy there. So you have to ask him to give him his 2 weeks' notice, and while he's there, he did it. How about when somebody does something bad, they're fired, they're out of there, and they can't harm anybody?
So I love that.
Take our guns away.
I love that. To me, that's the most sensible thing. You know, people get fired from work. Remember, it was like the old thing was, you know, you would go postal, right? Somebody got fired from the post office, went back and shot everybody. I mean, if you're not there and there's no, it shouldn't be 2 weeks. Like, we'll pay it for 2 weeks, but all your cards, all your access is rescinded, gone, goodbye, you know, and you can't get in. And the other thing is, I mean, I believe that if somebody was armed there, 15 people wouldn't have been dead, or however many are now. I mean, people are still in ICU. I mean, somebody would have taken out a gun and shot the guy in the head. So maybe, you know, half as many people are dead, nobody dead. He would have saved some lives. But everybody's in there, they're sitting ducks, they're defenseless, because it's a no-gun zone, but it's the no-gun zone only for the people that don't want to do harm to others. I mean, as I said, when the guy went in there with his two handguns and the silencer and the rounds, and there was a thing posted that said no guns, what did he do? Go back in his truck? Said, oh, well, I can't go in there and shoot it up. There's a photocopy on the desk. I mean, come on, man. Come on. And now this governor, Governor Tunnels, which is, he's a complete weasel. I mean, I cannot take the guy seriously. Anything he does ever since the moonwalk thing. Now he wants to hold a special session so he can be the great, you know, now he's going to be the great gun grabber of all time. Good luck with that.
Well, Governor Tunnels doesn't want to be known for opening up a casino and allowing us to make money. He wants to be known for having a baby, making the baby comfortable, and then executing the baby and taking away our guns. It's like he's on the side of a criminal. I mean,
it's really
the
sick.
Guy with the gun, he got the gun legally. What do you want to do? Take away the guns from all the legal people, all the honest people here, so that we're victims to the people that get guns crooked? You know, because look at Chicago. They have the strictest gun rules, and look at their murder, the gun rate over there. It's out of control. Look at Texas. They have the most lax gun rules, and you're not going to break into a house in Texas because you're going to get shot.
You're going to get shot. That's it. I mean, look, it's – but the governor is going to take political advantage of this. It's like I said when I got on the air on Monday, the fact that the Democrats have exploited this shooting for political gain is really sickening. The whole thing is sick. These are sick people. And now Governor Northam, who nobody takes seriously, who's a complete joke – Governor Tunnels, I mean, he can't get in and out of the mansion without sneaking through a tunnel. I mean, he can't go to the dinner on 2 weeks from Saturday. I'm going to be there. I was Trump chairman of Virginia in 2015. Hopefully I'll be Virginia Trump chairman in 2020. Not only am I going to the Democratic dinner on June 15th, I'm broadcasting it live. I'm an invited guest. Like, I can go to the dinner and he can't. He can't even buy a table. They throw him out. I mean, the guy's a joke. And now he's like, oh, I'm going to have this special session and get all the legislators in so I can take your guns away based on Virginia Beach. I mean, the guy believes and stands for nothing but his own self-interest.
We the good people of Virginia need to stand up and say, no, we're not putting up with this. We need to stand up and be strong and say, no, Governor, no. Somebody needs to.
We need to do that. I can tell you that. All right. Rich from Virginia Beach, good call. Thank you.
You're listening to The John Frederick Show. Common sense for the Commonwealth. On great radio stations across Virginia and online anytime at